Okay, so what I wanted to do was to give us just a little bit of a background on cesarean sections, both nationally and in the state, so that we have a framework for why the Joint Commission has selected the nulliparous term singleton vertex cohort as a focus for perinatal quality initiatives and measurement, ergo why we decided as a group, the picnic group did, that this was going to be the project for this year. It's easy sometimes when you're down in the weeds doing it yourself to sort of lose track of what else is going on. So let's try to give some national data, national perspective. Kate, I'm going to ask you, if you would, to if questions come up, to alert me in case I don't pick up on them, although I'll be trying to ask those or monitor those questions as well. And if you've got questions or comments, please do jump in. So this is the U.S. cesarean section rate between 1970 and 2008, where data was available. The sources of this are given at the bottom. And so this is a percentage of births in the U.S. overall, not the NTSV group, but overall percentages, rising to a peak in 2008 when the last data was available of about 32.3% of all births were by cesarean section in the United States. The nadir down there in the bottom of that roller coaster type of curve was about the peak of the VBAC rate, and so there's an inverse curve there that's risen rather steeply, as we all know, over the last 10 years. Trying to drill down a bit onto the U.S. data, this is from North Carolina Vital Statistics data. This is cesarean section by county of residence. So, for instance, for Orange County women here in Chapel Hill who deliver at Duke or at Durham Regional, they would be reflected not in Durham but in Orange County. You can see in the light blue is the North Carolina data. The orange is Orange County. Wake County sort of consistently exceeds, as does Mecklenburg County, the state numbers. And you can pull this out from the North Carolina Vital Statistics data yourself if you're interested in your own county. But again, each county, as well as the state, has continued to fairly rapidly increase over the last little bit. I used this slide with some hesitation, but I think it's really an important one. This is a website that is a national website called theunnecessarian.com, and it's got the data that is from the North Carolina Vital Statistics data that reflects each hospital cesarean section rate. So we've got a question here. Nope. Each hospital cesarean section rate, and I've pulled out each of the data from 2008 of the primary cesarean section rate. So this is not just the NTSV group. This is first-time C-section for a whole collaborative. And so you can see from Central Carolina's having a cesarean section rate of about 12%. All the way up to Bladen County, which is up at about 26%. There's a big variation that there's a big variation that exists across our own collaborative, and I'm sure represented in the other hospitals in North Carolina as well. So, you know, we can begin to dissect this, but this is data that our patients see, our payers see, lawyers see, anybody else can see. It's actually sort of an interesting website, and I'd recommend you take a look at it. But you can find your own hospital there. So what are the what are the sort of drivers of the cesarean section rate, and what are the things that we can control and some of the things we can't control? Because I think it's really important to understand what we can't control. This is a slide from a 2009 article in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology looking at primary cesarean section rate by indication. The part on the left in the light blue is the overall cesarean section rate from 1991 to 92, all the way up to 2007, 2008. And you can see that the overall cesarean section rate has dramatically increased, but as is consistently shown over and over again based on race of the patient. So African-American women have a significantly higher rate of cesarean section, and as shown on the right side, their odds ratios are significantly higher, up to 1.5 times higher than whites or Hispanics. Lots of thoughts about why that might be. Clearly, we can't affect the race of our patients, but if there are systematic things that are happening in our thinking about those different races, then we ought to take those into account. This next slide, perhaps a little small on your screen, but begins to look at primary and cesarean section in women with singleton births among white women compared to black women in the Kaiser system. Not a huge difference between the two groups as far as the indications are concerned, although the rates of non-reassuring fetal status as being the reason for the C-section was somewhat higher consistently, as well as the dystocia rates for African-American women. Let's look a little bit deeper here. This shows a bit about what I mentioned on that first graph, which is as the VBAC rate declined in the early 2000s, the primary cesarean section rate went up, but disproportionately the total cesarean section rate went up. Even so, it's that primary C-section rate that we're really focusing on in this trial. This goes from that same data on the uncesarean, which shows the extremes for the primary cesarean section rate of the county. Sorry, my phone was acting very weird. I apologize. So anyway, this slide goes over that same data, which shows that there's a threefold difference in primary cesarean section rates in hospitals in North Carolina, from Surrey, which has a 10% rate, all the way out to Duke, which has a little over 30% rate of primary cesarean sections. And clearly there's something going on amongst these different hospitals, our different hospitals, that would have that huge of a difference. That we could probably begin to address. So the drivers of the primary of the cesarean section rate, the rising rates, these are the ones I came up. I'm certain there are others, but maternal request, medical legal concerns, the increasing age of pregnant women, increasing complications in pregnancy, maternal obesity, provider preference. We think certainly someone this morning mentioned that as a driver at their hospital or a challenge. Induction of labor protocols, the training of different providers, the fact that there's increased reimbursement to hospitals and physicians for C-sections versus vaginal births, so there's a financial disincentive and changing VBAC standards. So if we begin to break those down, let's look at the contribution of those different things. This is from an article in 2008 looking at maternal request cesarean section. It really is very uncommon for primary cesarean section or for cesarean sections in multiparous women to request a C-section if they've not had one before. This is using no indication for the cesarean section given as a surrogate for maternal requests. But for primiparous women over 1996 to 2003, the rate has increased. This is nationally from about 6% to close to 10% of those women who have a cesarean section do so without indication. So although it's not a huge bump, it certainly contributes to this. And most importantly, our PICNIC trial is not looking at this population other than perhaps by education of patients. If we look at the medical legal risks, I think this slide pretty much suggests that that's not a major driver here.
at least looking at it at the macro level. This is a graph or a slide of the states with the 2007 cesarean section rates by state. You can see the highest rates are Florida, Mississippi, Louisiana, West Virginia, and I guess that's Delaware. And if you look at the malpractice crisis states, there are 19 of them. Trying to overlap those, you really don't get a very clean overlap. Of the five states with the highest cesarean section rates, four of them are among the AMA's malpractice crisis states. But of the 19 malpractice crisis states, it's sort of distributed across there, suggesting there's not a really strong relationship, although perhaps some. This is really important, and again, something that we have absolutely no control over, and it's shown over and over again. As women age, their cesarean section rate goes up, so you can see for the under 18-year-old woman, her section rate in the mid-teens. For a older woman, her rate's up at about 60% and then distributed all the way down by age group below that. We can't do a darn thing about that. Unless we are systematically pulling the trigger faster on older women. But it is a driver, and as you look at your data, you should be able to see whether you've got a large proportion of older women. Trying to look at whether maternal health problems and complexity increase the rate of cesarean sections, there's actually very little hard data to suggest that. De Klerk did a study showing there was no evidence to support increasing rates of maternal health problems as significant causes. It's really hard to disentangle it from maternal age-related increases in cesarean section rate because certainly as women get older, they get more medical problems. And then one of my mentors, and well-known to many in the audience, Dr. Cefalo, used to say to treat medical problems medically and surgical problems surgically. There are very few medical problems that require a surgical intervention. So really, we can't say that increasing rates of maternal health problems are a strong driver of our C-section rates. Obesity, though, seems to be, and we're all sharing the wealth on this one. This is a study on effect of maternal obesity on outcomes related to obesity, and you can see that for BMIs under 30, which some of those are still going to be overweight women, all the way up to the morbidly obese patient with a BMI over 40, all of the indicators would show that there's longer rates of labor, at longer times of labor, more inductions of labor, slightly bigger babies on average, but the C-section rate is increased significantly. And C-section for failure to progress is increased significantly in the obese patients. So that is, again, not anything we can do anything about other than in our preconception counseling of patients strongly suggest that they try to lose some weight before they get pregnant. Further looking at outcomes for obese parturients, Barron et al. Did a study reported in 2010 again, showing significantly higher cesarean section rates and induction rates in women who are obese, longer operating room times, more problems with the babies, ICU admissions, and respiratory complications. Useful data as we're counseling our patients. Again, getting to provider preference, this was commented upon. This was an article from Healthcare Management Science in 2005. Looks at cesarean sections in privately insured versus publicly funded patients. And there are some suggestions of why there might be a higher section rate in the privately paid patients. Certainly, women who seek and get their care from private physicians as opposed to a clinic status have a closer relationship with their doctor and will have more of a sway with the doctor in requesting a cesarean section. The doc may find it harder to withhold a cesarean section. Older patients tend to have greater socioeconomic status and therefore are seen in private hospitals more frequently. The racial disparities tend to favor a private situation. We all know, as was pointed out, that there are higher rates of cesarean deliveries before midnight, which suggests a provider issue. And there are different practice styles. Patients talk to each other, and if they know that one practice is more likely to do a cesarean section, some women will non-randomly distribute themselves to those patients, to those doctors. So we hope that we can influence some of these provider issues. On the other hand, they are there, and we need to acknowledge that they're there. This is where the money is, though. This is what we can do something about, and we'll spend a little bit more time this afternoon talking about this. But induction of labor and how that affects the cesarean section rate. Between across the country, between 1989 and 2003, the rate of inductions went up almost threefold, from 8% to almost 22%. The odds ratios for a cesarean section in a induced versus spontaneous labor is about 30% higher by one study reported in 2009. Looking internationally at over 47,000 births, 38% of all the cesarean sections were done in induced women, induced nulliparous women. Now, it could be that these were not low-risk women. These were all women being induced. They might have been 24-weekers or they might have been 41-weekers, so it's hard to pull this out, but pretty clearly induction of labor plays a role in our cesarean section rate. This is data from one of the hospitals in the PICNIC project. So by definition, these were women under 39 weeks of age, of gestational age, and I pulled out just those who were admitted at 1 to 2 centimeters dilated. Small numbers, but you can see, I think, that the overall rate in this hospital was a 74% vaginal delivery rate. There were variations in the types of cervical ripening that were done, but importantly, and this data we're going to share after lunch, but it's going to be pretty eye-opening, I think. Among the first-stage C-sections, almost half of them were done at 1 to 3 centimeters dilated with a pretty small average birth weight, and one might suggest, and I think I hope most of you will look at your C-section rates for failure to progress in the latent stage of labor. Provider training is really important. This is a study at a single hospital in the UK. They had no change in demographics over the time of the study. It was about a 10-year trial, and there was a significant flip-flop of the rate of the use of forceps over the rate of vacuums. There was one VE per five forceps in 1992, and by 2001 there were two vacuum deliveries per forcep delivery. They showed an increased failure of operative vaginal delivery attempts, so that when something was done it was less effective, and a decreased number of attempts overall. And I think most of the docs listening here will recognize that in general we are being trained in operative vaginal deliveries as well as we were 20 years ago, and that is affecting what we do. Now, what about the reimbursement rates for cesarean section versus vaginal birth? That's probably not a big factor. This was a study in 2009 showing that for every increased reimbursement of $1,000 for a C-section versus a vaginal birth, there was little more than a 1% increase in the C-section rates in the model. So I found that somewhat reassuring that the money payment is not a big driver here. What about VBACs? This again shows that the VBAC rate peaked in the mid-90s and then has fallen back down almost to the levels that were present in 1985. The ACOG bulletin, if you're going to look at your VBAC rate, which you know would be separate from the NTSV project because that doesn't include multiparous women, suggests that there are lots of things we can do in a potential TOLAC patient, including external cephalic version, induction without the use of prostaglandins, and that we should be offering, if our hospital is capable of doing so, VBAC. And not just suggesting that everyone use a trial of labor. There is a nice little website. I've given you the reference for it here, which is a pretty good tool for counseling patients regarding the chances that they would be able to deliver vaginally if they had a trial of labor, and I would recommend that, again, in your patient counseling. And I've just for kicks and giggles, I've added in some pretty good data that's coming out now that you increase your risk of uterine rupture if you use a single layer closure with your previous C-section or your interpregnancy interval is less than 18 months. So clearly our intraoperative work makes a difference in our risks later. Predicting VBAC success, this is where a crystal ball would be great. The neonatal respiratory morbidity and neonatal length of stay is lowest for the patient who has a successful trial and highest with those who fail. So if you could tell who's going to fail, great to know that, and again, would be important in our counseling. So very briefly, what's the problem with cesarean sections and why do we want to avoid them? In the index pregnancy, the rate of peripartum hysterectomy is higher with the primary cesarean section by about 6.5-fold and by 3.7-fold if you have a repeat versus a C-section. Endometritis rates are higher, wound infections, postpartum hemorrhage, all higher with cesarean sections in the index pregnancy. And you can see in the little table on the right the rates of postpartum hemorrhage associated with C-section are increased as well, although there are other risk factors for postpartum hemorrhage. Neonatal complications increase significantly with cesarean sections, except as you'll see in this graph, there's actually a higher rate of interventricular hemorrhage from this study in cesarean section patients with no labor. That's probably because in this study, the patients at higher risk for interventricular hemorrhage were delivered by C-section and not the other way around. And the injury rate here, other than for operative vaginal delivery, was no different between the normal vaginal delivery and the cesarean section patients. So that was not a significant difference. Risks in future pregnancies, if you've had one C-section, this is any prior cesarean sections. The rate of abnormal placentation, we're talking about placenta accreta with one previous C-section, is 0.3, increasing to 6.7 if you've had five or more C-sections. If you have a placenta previa, both Clark study and the MFMU study show a dramatic increase as the number of previous C-sections increase. And so clearly, if you can avoid that for a C-section, the rate of accreta in a following pregnancy is really quite low. Another slide that shows that. Maternal mortality with trial of labor versus elective repeats is certainly lower in your trial of labor patients. So very briefly, the NTSV patients, these are nulliparous term singleton vertex patients. This is the group we're looking at in this project. You take out the women who have obstetrical indications for C-section and the women who have C-section by maternal request, and this is the group we're looking at. And what are the strategies that you might want to be looking at and that we'll be providing information about to improve the vaginal delivery for this folks? Certainly patient education regarding the normal course of labor starting early on in her pregnancy, awaiting spontaneous labor and avoiding the induction altogether. You have to induce someone, try to avoid the patient with the unfavorable cervix. If you've got to induce someone with an unfavorable cervix, as in there's a medical indication or an obstetrical indication for doing so, use some sort of effective cervical ripening technique. If you've got someone over 41 weeks, induce her and not await labor because there's good data suggesting rate of cesarean section in the post-AIDS, true post-AIDS patient. After 41 weeks. Don't admit the patient in prodromal labor unless you have to. Clearly, once a patient's admitted, we want to do something, and sometimes it's best to let nature take its course. Standardize your Pitocin and induction protocols. Provide good labor support, and be very patient with prodromal labors. So I went through that fairly quickly because of my drop out of about 5 minutes and trying to stay on time. But that is sort of the overall view of cesarean sections and where we wanted to kick this off.